Well, hello and welcome to August 2013 Message of the Month. This is Alistair Begg, and again, I thank you for your continued involvement with us by your prayers and by your giving. On behalf of all of the team here, I want to let you know just how much we appreciate that. The message for the month, I hope you will find helpful, since August is a time when students are starting or returning to college. We thought that this message might be a good reminder to them as they make friends. I delivered this message a little while ago to a group at our church, mainly of young singles, and we entitled it, Who Should I Marry? And I think as you listen to it, you will be able to decide whether it's the kind of thing you would like to pass on or not. Well, I understand the brief that has been given to me tonight, and I take it as a privilege, and I take it seriously. And I always want to make sure, whenever I do anything at all, that it's pretty clear to people whether one's remarks are essentially textual in the sense of expounding a passage of Scripture or not, that the Bible is absolutely foundational to all that we are considering in relationship to any subject at all. And where the Bible is absolutely clear, then we can be absolutely clear. Where the Bible is absolutely dogmatic, we can be dogmatic. Where the Bible is not necessarily clear on something, we should avoid being more clear than the Bible. And when the Bible is not dogmatic about an issue, then we do a disservice to the Scriptures when we introduce a dogmatism that is not even there. I say that simply because the matter of relationships is a very important matter. In fact, you could say that relationships matter more than anything else in all of life. Friendship, and whether that's between the sexes or opposite sexes, they're of vital importance. So what I want to do is I want to read a passage from the Bible, and I notice there are Bibles around, and I want to read from Genesis chapter 24. And I'm not going to read it all, but I want to read enough of it. It's a fantastic story, and if you don't know the story, there are 66 verses in Genesis chapter 24, and so obviously if I read all 66, we'll be here for quite a while, and I'd rather just give a flavor of it and let you continue from there. Some of you will be familiar with it, others of you will not, and I'm actually looking forward to reading this story to my granddaughter. She's far too young now to pay any attention to it, but the day will come, God willing. Abraham was now old and well advanced in years, and the Lord had blessed him in every way. He said to the chief servant in his household, the one in charge of all that he had, "Put your hand under my thigh." That might seem really strange to you, but it was an Eastern gesture, an expression of peculiar intimacy in such a way as to take an oath. And he says, "Put your hand under my thigh. I want you to swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of the earth, that you will not get a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I am living." I don't want you getting, he's not getting his wife from here, he says. "But instead you will go to my country and my own relatives and get a wife for my son Isaac." The servant asked him, "What if the woman is unwilling to come back with me to this land? Shall I then take your son back to the country you came from?" "Good question. Make sure that you do not take my son back there," Abram said. "The Lord, the God of heaven, who brought me out of my father's household and my native land, and who spoke to me and promised me an oath, saying, 'To your offspring I will give this land,' he will send his angel before you so that you can get a wife for my son from there." That's quite a deal. We're asking the question, who should I marry? He gets a deal where there's an angel goes in front, paving the way. I'm going to suggest to you that none of us have that as an option. No matter how much you may love your mom, she is not an angel going in front of you. "If the woman is unwilling to come back with you, then you will be released from this oath of mine. Only do not take my son back there." So the servant did the business concerning this matter, and then he took off with his master's camels, 10 of them, and with all kinds of good things from his master. And he set out for Aram Naharaim and made his way to the town of Nahor. He made the camels kneel down near the well outside the town. It was towards evening, the time the women go out to draw water. So there's a methodology in what he's doing here. He's supposed to get a wife, so let's go where there are women. Some guys are not smart enough to figure that out. Or when they get there, they don't know what they're doing when they get there. But anyway, so he gets where the women are, and then he prays. That's good as well. Oh, Lord God of my master Abraham, give me success today and show kindness to my master. Then he says, telling the Lord, see, I'm standing here beside this spring, and the daughters of the townspeople are coming out to draw water. God says, yes, I can see that, but thanks for mentioning it in any case. May it be that when I say to a girl, please let down your jar that I may have a drink, and she says, drink and I'll water your camels too, let her be the one you have chosen for your servant Isaac. By this I will know that you have shown kindness to my master. Now, let me just pause there for a moment and say, I run into young people all the time who tell me that they are into the process of relationships in the biblical way. Not like some of the rest of the crazy people that are coming around transit. They've got the true biblical way of doing it. Oh, really? You mean like this? A few camels down by the well, waiting for somebody and angels as well. For this is a very biblical way, isn't it? It's not the biblical way. It's a reminder to us that when we read our Bibles, the things that are descriptive are not necessarily prescriptive. And when we turn what is described into what then is prescribed when it isn't, then we get ourselves in a real mess. In the same way, if someone says, well, you go home, tell your dad, how was it? He says, it was not really very good because you're supposed to have a few camels and you go out sitting around waiting for girls to come around to help you with your camels. Your dad says, well, you're going to probably have to move. There's not many in the greater Cleveland area at the moment. Before he had finished praying, verse 15, it gets more exciting. Rebekah came out with her jar on her shoulder. She was the daughter of Bethuel, son of Milcah. Now notice this, who was the wife of Abraham's brother Nahor. So this is pretty good. The girl was very beautiful, it's getting even better. A virgin, absolutely exceptional. No man had ever lain with her, just if anybody doesn't understand what that means. And she went down to the spring, filled her jar, and came up again. The servant hurried to meet her. Of course he did. You better hurry up, because there may be another guy who's there on the same kind of mission. So he's not going to say, well, I'll get to it later on in the afternoon. No, no, he hurries up to her. Please give me a little water from your jar. Drink, my lord, she said, and quickly lowered the jar to her hands and gave him a drink. After she had given him a drink, she said, I'll draw water for your camels too, until they have finished drinking. So the whole thing is just going absolutely swimmingly. It's absolutely super. It then gets really sort of far out, where he puts a golden ring in her nose, which again, you could go home and tell your mother about, those of you who have been thinking along those lines. And he gives her a couple of wonderful bracelets. She, in turn, says, you can make your camels lie down here. That's around verse 25, 26. And the girl, verse 28, ran and told her mother's household about these things. That, incidentally, just in passing, is a very good principle. Whenever anything is rumbling around in terms of men coming to you and asking how you're watering your camels, then make sure that you do run home and tell your mother's household what's going on. Anytime you find yourself unable to run home into your house and unfold what's going on, particularly in the potential relationships with the opposite sex, it's probably a warning sign to you. It's probably a warning sign to you. Of course, you may have a situation at home where you just have been unable to cultivate that. I don't want to put anyone on a guilt trip in relationship to there. But if you have an open access within your home, it would be understandable that you would, like this girl, run home and tell your mom and dad all about these things. Rebekah had a brother named Laban. Aha, this is good as well. And he hurried out. See, everybody's hurrying. There's nothing lethargic about this. The guy hurries up, hurries back, the girl ran, her brother hurried to the man at the spring. Why? Because he's her brother. And I'll tell you what, any brother worth his salt wants to know who the guy is that's sticking nose rings in his sister and giving her gold bracelets. That's the kind of brother you want to have. You don't want a brother that says, oh yeah, you know, que sera, sera. No, Laban rushes out. As soon as he saw the nose ring, the bracelets on his sister's arms, and had heard Rebekah tell what the man said to her, he went out to the man and found him standing by the camels near the spring. Come, you are blessed by the Lord, he said. Why are you standing out here? I have prepared the house and a place for the camels. Then he goes in. I can't tell you all the story. I'm going to leave it to you because we'll be here all night. We could go through the whole story. It'd be about 9 o'clock, no questions, and the whole thing be a disaster. So there's a lot of drinking and not drinking and smoking. There's a lot of drinking and stuff going on. Mainly water from the thing and the jars and the camels and drinking and the ring in the nose, and I worshipped and praised and so on and da 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 and all the way, and it goes all long down da da da, and then we're down about verse 59 now. It was incidentally 56, but he said to them, "Do not detain me now that the Lord has granted success to my journey." In other words, I'm in a hurry here. I've got to get going. Send me on my way that I may go to my master. Then they said, "Well, let's call the girl and ask her about it." It's the first time she gets to say anything. It's fascinating, isn't it? So they called Rebecca and asked her, "Will you go with this man?" "I will go." That's pretty decisive, wasn't it? It's not like, well, let me think about this for 5 minutes, or we've got to go to the thing at transit and find out who you're supposed to marry. No, will you go? I'm going. So they send their sister Rebecca on her way along with her nurse and Abram's servant and his men. And they blessed Rebecca and said a little song about her. Verse 61, then Rebecca and her maids got ready, mounted their camels, and went back with the man. So the servant took Rebecca and left. Now Isaac had come from Beer Laharoi, for he was living in the Negev. Now here's the boy. Here's the guy she's going to marry. She's never met him yet. That's fascinating, isn't it? She didn't find out if he graduated or if he had a camel. A turbo camel. Now, from his perspective, it gets really heavy because he'd gone out to the field one evening to meditate. The footnote says, we don't really know what that verb is. So he was out there thinking deep thoughts or doing something. And as he looked up, he saw camels approaching. Rebecca also looked up and saw Isaac. Cue the music. Okay, we're building the movie now. Rebecca also looked up and saw Isaac. She got down from her camel and asked the servant, "Who's that guy? Who is that man in the field coming to meet us?" She probably liked him. She probably looked and said, "Oh man, look at this guy. Mr. Meditator." "He is my master," the servant answered. Now, look at this sentence, if your Bible is there. Verse 65, last sentence. So she took her veil and covered herself. What's up with this girl? Don't you know how this works? At this point, you're supposed to uncover yourself. You're supposed to let everybody know what you've got, especially Isaac. If the guy's going to all this trouble and we've got angels and camels and people going all over the place, and now it gets to the point, who's that guy? That's my master. This is the guy. So she took her veil and she covered herself. It's fascinating, isn't it? So instead of unrobing, instead of disrobing, instead of saying, "Hey," she says, "Hey." Then the servant told Isaac all he had done. A lot of stuff, right? Because, I mean, we've already abbreviated the 60-odd verses. That took a while. Isaac must have been looking at him, and then two looks at Rebecca, one look at him, and two looks at her, saying, "I wonder what she looks like underneath all that veil stuff." And Isaac brought her into the tent of his mother Sarah, and he married Rebecca. So she became his wife, and he loved her. And Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. It's a great story. It's a great story. And I wanted to read that story because it is so alien to any kind of Western concept, whatever it is, even Christian concept of the nature of interpersonal relationships, the discovery of a spouse, and so on. And obviously, it is so alien to us that there is, in some senses, very little that we can do with it in terms of direct application to principles in relationship to the question that is before us this evening. I recognize that the question is somewhat facetious in me being given the responsibility to answer such a vast question. We recognize that. But the reason that it is of such significance is because we know how important it is. Now, with that as the foundation, if you like, the metaphor of me turning to the Bible so that you will say, well, then I must turn to the Bible if I'm going to take this seriously. Let me just give you a couple of reflections, a couple of observations, a couple of principles, and a couple of suggestions. Okay? Reflections, observations, principles, suggestions. The reflections will pass in the blink of an eye. This is my reflection. I used to be single. I just wanted you to know that. Because you may think, no, he was always married, this guy. He's a strange bird. He's a strange duck. No, I was single right up until the 15th of August, 1975. All right? On the 16th of August, 1975, I ceased to be single. And I have been married in the goodness of God ever since. For those of you who would be interested, I could tell you the wonderful romance story of how I met my wife when I was 16 and she was 13. And how we wrote letters for 7 years to one another, four of them across the Atlantic Ocean. How I had to write like a fiend in order to fight off American boys who wanted to take her to the prom, who wanted to take her to the movies, who wanted to take her to the ball game, who wanted to take her everywhere. And all I had at the distance of 3,000 miles was a pen and a piece of notepaper. The pen is powerful, incidentally. The pen is powerful. And the communication that unfolded there allowed me to move from adolescent dreaming to the reality of marital joy. Not everyone has such a story. Not everyone need of such a story. But I can honestly tell you tonight that from the minute that I set my eyes on this 13-year-old girl around the dining room table of our home in suburban London, I never ever wanted to marry anyone else. I never ever thought I could marry this girl. After all, you're 16. She's 13. How could you ever get married? You would have to wait 100 years before you get married. There would be camels and all stuff that you'd have to go through to get there. But the future unfolds at the rate of 60 seconds a minute, and there we are. As a father, I have 3 children. A son who's single, who as yet has never married, not for lack of girls that could marry, but those he could marry. I guess in his case, the desirable was unattainable and the attainable was undesirable so far. And so when the two things, when the, did you get that? The desirable is unattainable, the attainable is undesirable. So you need the two of them coming together. So as yet that hasn't happened, plus he's broke, so it's no matter how funny he is, no girl is signing up for this one. So anyway, he is a work in process in relationship to this very question, and my daughters are both married, and we have lived through this story with them, fighting off boys that we thought ought to get out of our house, living with the reactions, the tears, the "you must hate me, Dad, to send him away. If you truly loved me, you would let me be with him," all those kind of things. And then the response, "honey, is there anyone loves you more in the entire world than me?" "No, Dad." "Then if I love you more than anyone else in the world, do you think that what I'm saying to you tonight is in order to spoil your life, to ruin your life, to impoverish you in some way?" "No." "Then you're going to have to make a choice." And parents are confronted with that responsibility. If parents bottle that, then they're going to have to leave it up to siblings to do it. And if brothers or sisters can't speak into each other's lives, then they do a great disservice to the person. Because in actual fact, no matter what we might say, we are phenomenally dependent on the coercive influence, on the encouraging undergirding of those whom we love and admire in the world, whether they be friends or family members. And in relationship to my own life, as a boy, as a growing up, as a young man, I have two sisters, both of whom have been married now for a long time, 25 years, 30 years, I think. And in both cases, I had the privilege of introducing my sisters to their husbands. I don't say that out of any sense of pride, but I say that I fought long and hard to throw a lot of guys out of the house. And again with my sisters, why did you throw those roses in the garbage? It's not, they're not your roses. Why would you put them in the garbage? Because I don't like the guy who gave them to you. Yeah, but he's a very nice guy. I know him from the rugby club. He's not a nice guy. Yeah, but you don't know everything. I don't know everything, but I do know this. And if I were to bring them up here tonight, they would now say from the vantage point of time, thank God that Alistair was prepared to endure our wrath in order to save us from making stupid mistakes. We need one another. Anytime, incidentally, that we have to go away by ourselves and convince ourselves and deny the input of those whom we love and respect in a decision of this kind of magnitude, guarantee yourself you're up the creek. You're wrong. Because every other decision in life is a decision on which you have depended, at least in measure, on all these things. Stop. Reflections are over. Observations, part two. It seems to me that there's only one couple that got this with absolute dead-on clarity, right? In the entire universe. Namely, Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve. And in actual fact, they got it because God removed all choice. You know, it wasn't like, do you want Eve or you want to wait for somebody else? No, it was Adam. Now, here's Eve. Eve, here's Adam. Have at it, so to speak. That is a paraphrase of go forth and multiply, which is actually in the Bible, which is similar to have at it. So, Adam and Eve had absolute clarity, a clarity that we can't get, right? Because of choice. Choice is a blessing, but it's also a curse. You know, the menu at that place, Cheesecake Factory. I mean, what in the world are you supposed to do with that? If somebody invites you to go to the Cheesecake Factory, like meet them at 6, go around 4:30 so you can just start working your way through the menu. And you're going through and through and through, and the choice, or no, or page 9, no, I'll try 11, no, 14, 27, whatever. It's a curse. If it is a curse in the menu, it's a challenge in terms of picking a spouse, isn't it? That's why I'm not so sure that arranged marriages aren't bad. You say, wait a minute now. If we didn't come in here for this, we better get moving on now. No, I don't want to overstate this. But if you think about it, if most of you, you have to go over to your granny's house to watch Fiddler on the Roof. And then it'll be a punishment and it'll be Thanksgiving Eve or something, okay? But if ever you get put through that process, you know, you'll find that, or you've seen it in the stage play in Broadway or perhaps here in Cleveland, and you get that wonderful song that I always love to quote. Is this the little girl? No. You know, do you love me? That's the question that he asks his wife, remember? Do you love me? Do I love you? You know, and it goes on. And one of the great lines is, because your father and your mother said we'd learn to love each other. Your father and your mother said we'd learn to love each other. The concept of learning to love is an alien concept in the date world of 21st century America. Love, if it means anything, is governed largely by eroticism, by feelings, so that we may then determine whether anything is going on this particular front. Not in isolation from everything, but it tends to be the driver, as opposed to the notion of growing into a relationship of love. It's fascinating, actually, in the New Testament letters, that when Paul gives instruction to other young fellows who are leading the church, he actually says, in this way, you can teach the women to love their husbands. Teach them to love. So the observation is simply this, that when we talk in terms of a biblical approach to discovering who I should marry, it immediately takes us into a world that challenges the presuppositions with which we live all the time. I don't want to get into the commercials from the Super Bowl. But I mean, the few that I saw, and eventually I just turned it off because I'd just been preaching on the phrase, you know, avoid every kind of evil and cling to that which is good. And then I went home to watch the Super Bowl. And I said, I'm not sure I can watch these commercials and live by the jolly principle that I've just been teaching and being taught myself. How can I watch this? You saw the commercials. Or whether it was Stella Artois with the guy singing and crooning and making the girls cry. And then eventually, when everybody thinks that it's going to zero down on one of these fortunate females, it zeros down on a beer. Where are all the feminists for that? Why don't they all stand up and shout, bogus, rubbish? You're going to compare me to a beer? You got the exact same thing with Skechers. I didn't see it. You got the same thing with Pepsi. You remember the commercial? Do you see the commercial? She's saying, I wonder if he's this, I wonder if he's that, I wonder if he's the next thing. And he's saying, I want to sleep with her, I want to sleep with her, I want to sleep with her, I want to sleep with her. And there, you have epitomized for us not only the varied dimensions of male and female psyche pushed to the nth degree, but you also have a fairly accurate representation of where culture is. That's why it is so phenomenally challenging to be prepared to wrestle with biblical principles in relationship to these matters. I actually think that the issues of human sexuality probably call Christian commitment into, you know, sort of vibrant, stark contrast to the culture, probably more than any other thing. The issues of sexuality, whatever expressions they are, because the worldview of the Christian is so vastly different when it comes to these issues. So let me say these things. And I'm going to stick with my notes here because I'm rambling. I don't want to be here all night with you because you want to have a nice evening once you get rid of me. But all human relationships, including boy-girl relationships, are usually either helpful or they're unhelpful. They're seldom neutral. I mean, you can think back to maybe some platonic relationships that really worked or some friends. But most of the friends that I can remember, they were either like, you want to get drunk? Or would you like to go to a Bible study? I didn't have many friends like, it was either we're going crazy one way or another. You know, so it's either helpful or it's unhelpful. And the same is true in terms of physical relationships. Don't forget, God has set it up this way. He's the inventor of sex, he's the creator, he's the savior, and of all people, Christians should have the highest view of human sexuality. But relationships with people of the opposite sex become unhelpful when a number of things happen. Let me tell you what they are, without further elaboration. Number one, when the relationship becomes my main total preoccupation. Total preoccupation. Number two, when it separates me from others. When the relationship becomes an isolating thing. My friends can no longer see me now. I'm no longer meeting with them and so on because I've now become just totally transfixed and consumed. Thirdly, when it hinders my spiritual development. Fourthly, when it comes between me and the Lord Jesus. And fifthly, when the attraction is primarily physical. When the attraction is primarily physical. You know, C.S. Lewis, in I think it's in The Four Loves, he talks about a man says that a man wants a woman. C.S. Lewis says, when you hear a guy on about that, he doesn't want a woman. He wants what a woman can give him. And then he says, who's going to keep the packet when they've smoked the cigarettes? And one of the things that I've come up against as much as anything else in 35 years of pastoral ministry is young couples who have preempted this issue, who have allowed the physical dimension of the relationship to go from 0 to 100 miles an hour within 15 or 20 minutes. As a result of that, they've created a sense of appetite and expectation, which inevitably will dwindle and fade. If that couple have never become friends, if they have never learned to appreciate one another for all the other dimensions of life. If they have built it on that physical dimension, then one or two things will happen. Either it will fade away to nothing, or it will be maintained at a certain level, and either one of them or both of them will be forced to move on to other people. And when they want to preserve a sense of moral rectitude by not violating the marriage bounds by stepping outside with another guy or with another girl, then they can simply retreat to the safety of their bedroom and to the privacy of the internet. And trust me on this. These factors, these principles are crucial. To flip it round, though, a relationship with someone of the opposite sex is a good thing and a helpful thing when it encourages us to appreciate people of the opposite sex without undue stress upon commitment to one another. Let me just say that phrase again. That allows us to appreciate people of the opposite sex without the undue stress of commitment to one another. So that there's no sense of, well, we put it this way. We should never assume that a friendship has to be more than a friendship when it begins. And I'm so old now that I don't even know the terminologies, hooking up, dating, I don't know what they all mean. Because they all mean certain things now. Well, we're dating, but we're not hooking up. Well, we're hooking up, but we're not really dating. Well, we're seeing each other, but, well, we're not dating, but we're seeing, you know. I'm like, okay, if someone could interpret this for me, then I could maybe, once we get it into the English language, then I can find out what it means. I think I've got a modicum of understanding, and in most cases what it means is that there is undue stress placed on the situation, and people have assumed that this is going to be more than a friendship when it begins. It's also going to be helpful when it is governed by mutual respect, and not least of all, respect for the feelings of the other and for the physical makeup of the other person. I just give you this as something to go and work out on your own, perhaps. But if you think about it, Christian character is never addressed in the New Testament in isolation. Like, why don't you go in this lead room and work out Christian character? You know, if you've become a holy saint living in a hovel or living in a little whatever else it is. It never deals with that. Christian character is always worked out within the context of relationships. So, for example, the fruit of the Spirit in Galatians 5, the fruit of the Spirit is always expressed in terms of what it means in interpersonal relationships. So, love is not wrongly possessive. Love is not wrongly possessive. Love does not pursue selfish advantage. Therefore, it is important not to confuse what my physical desires may prompt with real love for the other person. Most of the people that come in and tell us that they have, quotes, fallen in love with their secretary, and that's why their wife of the last 20 years is, you know, she's just going to have to go take a back seat. They don't mean they've fallen in love with their secretary. They don't mean that for a minute. That's what they call it. The opposite of that, the fruit of the Spirit on the one hand, and then the works of the flesh on the other, which are to be avoided at all costs, among which are, says Paul, sexual immorality, impurity of mind, sensuality, jealousy, drunkenness, and reckless parties. You realize what a radically, radically different thing it is to bring the impact of Scripture to bear upon the most crucial decisions of our lives. All right, that goes under the heading of principles. And now we come finally to observations. Let me suggest to you that these things, and I'm not going to work these out. I did this before about 100 years ago when I was invited here. Nobody's still left. Scott and Mandy have chased them all away in the space of 4 or 5 years and sent them on. They've all moved up to the boring, whatever the next rung is here at Parkside. They're all running around with snotty-nosed little kids and they're stuck. But anyway, they're having it. That's for someone else to worry about. But I hear, what are you looking for in a husband? Who should you marry? At least this should be part of it, in my humble estimation. All right? You're looking for a husband? What characteristics? These are not in order of importance. One, he should possess the ability to lead with sensitive boldness. He should possess the ability to lead with sensitive boldness. I just was driven about 2.5 hours in a minivan, no, bigger than a minivan, with two little children and a husband in the back seat and the wife driving the van. The whole thing didn't appeal to me from the get-go, and it was an ordeal. And her husband was a really nice guy. I mean, he was a nice guy, but he was a weenie. And there is no other way to put it. It was like any time I asked a question, he would be like, well, I thought, and she'd come in, well, wait a minute, wait, sorry. I'm like, hey, keep your eyes on the road. We're trying to get to Richmond here, you know. Oh, I gave that away. But anyway, at least we've narrowed it down to Virginia. There's a weenie in Virginia if we can find it. The thing is, if the guy can't lead with sensitive boldness, then somebody's going to fill the vacuum. That's the point. And as soon as the vacuum is filled by a wife whose responsibility is different from that, but not because she doesn't have the capacity to lead. If she's worth anything at all, of course she's got the capacity to lead. Somebody's going to have to do something, aren't they? They can't all just stand around and say, well, what are we going to do next? Somebody has to say, well, why don't we get in the van? And the husband goes, well, that's a good idea. Yeah, well, of course it's a good idea. We're trying to get to Richmond, for goodness sake. All right? The ability to lead. Secondly, the ability to lead with sensitive boldness. The adjective is important. Secondly, the ability to love sacrificially. To love sacrificially. Thirdly, the ability to leave his family behind. Not a mommy's boy. He can love his mom. It's good to love your mom. And Isaac was sad because he lost his mom. And in some senses, God compensated for the loss of his mom by giving him this girl, the camel girl, Rebecca. And it actually says that, doesn't it? It's interesting. So it's not an irrelevancy. Most Italian guys are mommy's boys. They love their moms. They love the cooking. They love the family. And many Italian boys stay at home in Italy. And the same is true in Spain for a long time, living at home. Not because they don't have the ability to lead. It's the nature of the culture. When they step forward, they step forward. And I can't remember who it was, but when they had the wedding speeches and the mother and the father and the whole thing, the mother gave the girl, her new daughter-in-law, an apron. But as she gave it to her, she took out a pair of scissors and she cut the apron strings that tied it to her as a symbol of the fact that she was cutting, if you like, the umbilical cord between herself and her son. And it was now a whole new family unit and a whole new place. Fourthly, the ability to laugh heartily. The ability to laugh heartily. Laughing has the power to reconcile. Laughing alone does not have the power to reconcile, but you can usually laugh your way to it. And I think I remember I told the last time the story by Walt Wangren, which is a fantastic story. It sticks in my mind always. Walt Wangren's the guy who wrote the little book called The Ragman and Other Tales. And one of the stories he has in there is of the early days of he and his wife being married. And they got in a right barnstorm of a row. And so he decided, okay, well, this is fine. I can handle this. And so he decides he grabs his... No, he doesn't. So he decides, I'll just go out and walk around the neighborhood for a while. So he goes out, and he slams the door, and he looks outside from the apartment, and he goes, oh, for goodness sake, it's pouring rain. So he has to ring the bell. So when he rings the bell, his wife opens the door. It's an opportunity for reconciliation. He goes, I need my coat. Gets his coat. Slams the door again. Turns to walk away, and realizes that he slammed his coat in the door. So now he either has to take his coat off and go out and walk in the rain, or he's got to ring the doorbell again. He rings the doorbell again. His wife is killing herself laughing. And he says in the little piece, and in that moment, there was the opportunity of reconciliation. But like a fool, I grabbed my coat and slammed the door again. And fifthly, the ability to live prayerfully. in humble dependence upon the Lord. In actual fact, girls, we can put it, this is what you're looking for. You're looking for a guy who's hip, okay? Hip. You're looking for a hip? You're looking for a hip guy, aren't you? I mean, you're looking for, you know. No, let me tell you what hip is. This is my hip. A guy who's marked by humility, integrity, and purity. Humility, integrity, and purity. Those are entirely legitimate, fundamental basics for any Christian woman seeking a Christian husband. I realize our world in which we live, but it's not all sorted. It's not all gone to hell. And Christian families are bringing up children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. And you don't have to sell out. So keep your standards where they need to be. Looking for a wife? 6 things for a girl to look for, 5 for a husband. In the wife, 1, long legs. No, sorry, no. No, that wasn't in it. I just put that in for fun. 1, look for a beauty that is deeper than the skin. Look for a beauty that is deeper than the skin. That's not to say we go around saying, let's try and find something that I don't find physically attractive. But no, for a beauty that is deeper than the skin. I know girls who are absolutely fantastic. Funny, sensitive, maternal in their instincts, tender in their relationships. They are absolutely fantastic. And stupid guys are walking past them every day of the week. Because they are back getting their agenda from the commercials at the Super Bowl. Instead of getting their agenda from the Bible. Secondly, looking for a girl who's an initiative taker with a willingness to submit. An initiative taker who's willing to submit. You don't want somebody, you don't think Adam and Eve, I don't know whether it was not, but Adam and Eve, I don't think the whole notion of Adam and Eve is like Adam's up there going, all right, well, we've got the creation. All right, let's get this place put together. Eve, don't put the daffodils over there, Eve. I told you that the daffodils should be over on this side and the tulips over there. I'm going to go over here and smoke my pipe for a while. I'll be back. Make sure you've got it done. That's a sort of caricature of the idea of, you know, strength of leadership. Every husband knows. He's going, honey, what am I going to do with these daffodils? Tell me what to do. I spend my whole life going, Sue, what am I supposed to do now? She goes, well, I'll tell you. I said, good, help me out. It may not look like that from the front, but you don't need to know everything from the front. I'm telling you the truth. Thirdly, a girl with behavior that builds confidence. A girl with behavior that builds confidence. As opposed to a girl with behavior that attracts attention, that erodes confidence. See what I mean? A girl with behavior that builds confidence. But when we get behind closed doors and she lets her hair hang down, you don't need to know all that stuff. That's not what you do. You're not going out to the party to let your hair hang down and make everybody in the room lust after you so that it makes your guy feel really, you know, macho. That's garbage. That's nonsense. No. Let the people think whatever they want to think. Build a character that has behavior that allows the fellow to leave you alone for 10 days on a business trip in San Francisco because you've created such a track record of confidence. If you don't do it then, you ain't going to do it in your marriage. And people think, well, we'll fix it all when we get married. No, you don't fix it when you get married. It gets worse when you get married. If a guy won't do all these things before he gets you, you think he's going to do them afterwards? Why would he? What's his incentive? He didn't want to do it to start with. Why would he do it now? Fourthly, and this fits, look at the way the girl dresses. You want her to dress attractively, you don't want her to dress seductively. Girls know the difference. So do guys. You know the difference between dressing attractively and dressing seductively. So does every guy in the room. Fifthly, she should be marked by a kindness that touches others. A kindness that touches others. That's why it's good to see each other. That's why you need a gestation period in these things, so that you can see one another in context. You know, you find out whether the guy is a really impatient rascal just by driving with him. You find out what he's really like when you have to go and visit one of his relatives who has multiple sclerosis. And you find out whether the guy has any kind of empathetic interest in people who are disabled and disenfranchised. You find out much more about the girl when she throws lines away that are not really meant for anything, but she sends out a signal. And also, finally, a girl that has a kind of humor that takes you through adversity. Scott and I have been involved this week to one degree or another, with three individuals for whom we all prayed on Sunday, and they all died during the week. David, after a long and grueling battle with and his wife, you talk about for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health. I mean, I saw them. I was having a salad in Heinen's probably 3 years ago, and I hadn't seen either of them. I hadn't seen them at church. I didn't know what was going on. And then I saw this poor guy walking into the place. He was a shadow of himself. He couldn't hardly hold himself up. And his wife by his side, and by his side all the way through until 2 o'clock this afternoon. Henry, married 64 years, sitting, holding his bride's hand in the bed. She's completely comatose, and she's on her way into eternity. And you can't fake that at year 64. You don't get to year 64 like that without the progressive building of one and two, and through the times that are encouraging and so on. Time is gone, so I'll stop. But practical guidelines. This is going to sound like your Uncle Al giving you this stuff. I know this sounds totally, he's like, oh, you know, we knew he was kind of nuts, but not as bad as this. Let me give you the practical guidelines. Number one, incidentally, see this dating thing and everything? Well, we're not dating. Well, what are you planning on doing? Call it whatever you want. You've got to go out with guys and girls. You've got to be able to go and do stuff together. I mean, what? Unless you're Rebecca, unless we're doing the camel thing. And if you're holding out for that, have a great life as a single. But if not, then, you know, I'll just say three things. To some of you, here's my word to you. Lighten up. Okay? If the cap fits, wear it. To others of you, here's my word to you. Tighten up. Tighten up. Cut the nonsense out. To others of you, brighten up. Brighten up. I mean, are you trying to make yourself look as morose and miserable and holy as you possibly can so that you will be entirely unattractive to anybody of any sex at any time of any day or night? Brighten up. You know? So, lighten up, tighten up, brighten up. Leave that on the side. Here are the final things. If you're going to hang out with one another, number one, do things that are profitable together. Oh, golly, here we go. This sounds like 1962 or something. Where do you get this stuff from? Probably about 1962. In other words, don't just want to be together without constructive activity. Because it's the old adage, but the devil finds things for idle hands to do. Okay? And if you don't actually set your stall up to do things that allow you that freedom, then it's almost inevitable that you will default to the physical realm. And as soon as you default to the physical realm, and as soon as that default mechanism becomes yours, then that just consumes your whole relationship. So the whole thing is, well, let's go to a movie, And then let's get out of the movie as fast as we can so we can go and grope one another somewhere and you know, hopefully take it as far up to the limit as we can without blowing our whole life out. So in other words, this is not an invitation to a movie. This is a forerunner of what I really want to get to. It's not, would you like to go and do this together? It's actually a mechanism. And that's where we have skill in figuring out who's who and what's what. The more things you do in the company of other people, the better. So, for example, it's far better to come and spend time in prayer in a small group here at Transit than it is to tell the girl, we're going to have our own little prayer time. Well, that first guy that tells me he's having his own little prayer time with my daughter, I'll kick his sorry butt right up Solon Road. You ain't having no special prayer time with my daughter, all right? You understand that? Why not? You don't trust me? I'm very holy righteous. My father was a pastor. I've got a son whose father was a pastor as well, and he ain't having prayer times, I'll guarantee you. All right? And along with that, and it's obvious, don't anticipate marriage in any of its aspects. I mean, if you just make that as your deal, don't anticipate marriage in any of its aspects. In other words, don't allow the intimacy to belong to marriage, in which the fulfillment of marriage to complement one another is there. Don't mess around with that. A good rule is, if in doubt, don't. Thirdly, be disciplined. Disciplined. This is something that, you know, again, I sound like a Neanderthal on this, but late nights very quickly become the norm for boy-girl relationships. I've noticed that people go out much later now. I'm going to bed when people are going out. Now, I understand. You say, well, you're an old person. That's what old people do. I know that. But nevertheless, late nights easily have a harmful effect on your spiritual life. Easily have a harmful effect on your spiritual life. Okay? You go to bed late, you get up late, soon you lose out. Three things and I'm done. Pray about your relationships. Be honest with yourself and God about them. Be clear in your mind that any relationship that is going to develop into marriage must be with someone who is a Christian. Be clear in your mind that any relationship that's going to develop into marriage must be with someone who's a Christian. Why? Because that's God's will. 2 Corinthians 6, Malachi 2. So if a non-Christian shows interest in you, that doesn't mean you can't show friendship. But what it does mean is that you have to be uncompromising in your testimony and your standards, and you need to be prepared to put a brake on the relationship before the relationship becomes more important to you than your relationship with Jesus. And you see, if we compromise our standards at whatever level, emotionally, physically, intellectually, and we've already crossed the Rubicon, then it's really hard to pull back. Some guy comes on to a girl, he puts the moves on her, He's physically demanding of her. And then sometime on a cold Tuesday, he wants to let her know that he's actually a Christian. She goes, a Christian? What do you mean you're a Christian? Well, yeah. He said, well, don't we have the thing backwards here? Penultimately, when you have a boy-girl relationship, male-female relationship, don't allow it to spoil your relationship with all of your friends. You know, you know this. You remember at university, at college, some guy, the whole thing was a guy, you know, now, don't talk to Joe. Why? He's with her, you know. Yeah, well, so I can't talk to him? No, he doesn't like it now. He's pretty, you know. So you see him, and he's standing outside the ladies' restroom, just standing, good old Joe, waiting for, you know, Becky to come out. Because that's what they do. And then you'll see her some days, and she's just standing outside. You see them at the table, don't go over to their table. No, they don't like that. As soon as you get involved in that, you know, that's called the first year of married life in some measure. But it's not called developing a relationship with someone of the opposite sex. Because we need our friends to go, what the heck's that about? What are you doing that for? Are you sure that's right? And finally, whatever happens, do not allow other people to make you anxious or to feel inferior if you do not have an established relationship with someone of the opposite sex. Do not allow others to make you anxious or to feel in any way inferior if you do not have an established relationship with someone of the opposite sex. Always put your relationship with the Lord first. Trust in His word. Trust in His promise. Psalm 84:11. There is no good thing the Lord will withhold from those who walk uprightly. So that nothing that God has for you will ever miss you. And anything that misses you, He doesn't have for you. Therefore, you can rest content.
Well, there you have it. As I say, I hope you'll find it to be of use, either with your own children or perhaps with a friend or somebody who is about to make decisions and plans that need to be constrained by the teaching of the Bible. And let me say to you as well that this month on Truth for Life, we're actually featuring a new volume of our Encore series. And we've chosen these messages as a result of the downloads and hard copy purchases of our listeners. So you've actually had a part in this month's programming. If you're traveling this month, don't forget to pack your Truth for Life app on your phone or your tablet. It's a great way to introduce a friend to the ministry, and you can find it online. Our website remains truthforlife.org. Our customer service line is 888-588-7884. And, of course, we always enjoy your letters that come, letters at truthforlife.org. So I hope you're enjoying August or will enjoy August, and I look forward to talking with you next month. Thank you.